And I'm going to talk about double crop production in the Mid-Atlantic. Now, I alluded to this earlier, but I'm proud to say that we are the experts, at least in a wheat, soy, or small grain soybean system. When I say we, I'm not talking about myself or my colleagues that you see on the screen, but I'm talking about our farmers. I think the first published paper of no-tilling soybean and wheat stubble came out in the early 80s. That was out of Virginia. We've been no-tilling soybeans and wheat stubble since the 60s. Jim, I don't know. Maybe earlier? I don't know. But we're probably at that stage. But Jim Dunphy's in the audience, I see. It's myself, Jim, Bob Kratich, Phil. I want to especially thank Russell Parvez. We hired him as a postdoc a couple of years ago, and he's been leading this really three-year research project we've had. Greg Roth and Corey Whaley. And there's a number of names on here that I do not mention, that I don't have on the screen, but I should mention because they've been involved with at least our recent efforts up until now. This is something I always like to lead off with when I'm talking about double crop production. Unfortunately, it's used for cover crops more so than double crop. I do truly believe that our systems will come into play when we keep that field green the entire year. Double cropping is a way to increase food, fiber, feed, and fuel total production. At the same time, we can meet some water quality, soil quality, you name it, environmental benefits with this. And quite honestly, cover crops don't feed the world, especially if you're not harvesting those cover crops. I need to specifically say that. We have some cover crops being grown and harvested for hay or silage, and that's a good thing. But as I mentioned earlier, the cover crops are taking some of our small grain acres, at least in Virginia. Once again, we are in a full season and double crop setting. Typically, we're about half and half in most of the Mid-Atlantic states. That's a good split for most growers because they can get their full season beans out of the way in October and then roll right into double crop beans in November or December. Someone mentioned the quality issues with double crop. If you're growing soybean for seed, most of those guys are double cropping because we're moving that maturity date into a later part of the season when it's cooler. There's less seed quality issues. So we're roughly about half and half. Now, I'll show you the acres or the hectares in this case. I'm going to probably be talking about acres, even though this is international meeting, so I'm going to try to stick with SI units. But, you know, this is the acres hectares of small grain that we have in each state. There's our hectares of soybean. I think you can see the split there. About 80, you know, this is the percent of the small grain acres that is double cropped. And most of that's going into soybean, even though we may have snap bean, could have, you know, numerous vegetable crops, even cotton is being looked at in some areas. Here's North Carolina, the further south we get. I don't have South Carolina pictured here. They'd be very similar. The further south you get, North Carolina, I would say almost all of those acres are being double cropped with something if it's not soybean. Now the problem is you move north. And these are the percentage of the soybean acres that are being double cropped. So you can see relatively high again. I don't know if this is at 39-degree latitude that Sean talked about, but we're getting pretty close around this area. And I think that's a pretty good ballpark figure for now. But we also have people that are double cropping that didn't used to double crop. Look across this area. We've averaged about 40%. The reason that's as low as it is really Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and that area. Now, we're not a big acreage state, but you're looking at total acres here. We're looking at a couple of million hectares of soybean, and nearly half of that is double crop. This hasn't changed much, but if I would take the last 5 years, this has dropped substantially. We're down to about 30% in Virginia. Wheat prices is a big issue, but also I've had many growers just tell me, especially when wheat prices were low, why do I take a risk with that when I can grow a cover crop, get paid for it in the Chesapeake Bay weeds area. That is very common to be paid quite a bit for a cover crop and guaranteed at least a little bit of money coming in from that winter crop. Now, prices of wheat are improving, so I imagine the acres will go back up. All right, Jim, I know if you can go to sleep now. I think you've heard everything from here on out. This is a graph Jim Dunphy showed me, I guess, 20 years ago when I first started at Virginia Tech. And I'm originally from NC State graduate, too, so it never hurts to show that. But Jim said this explains everything about planting date, at least in North Carolina in this area. I've yet to prove him wrong. He says they're, I think, 36 inches tall and lap in the middle. We're not going to get a yield reduction. Actually, we do get a little yield reduction, so I followed up on that. And, you know, half my research has been devoted to double crop, and we specified that. Leaf area index of 3.5 to 4. That's what we need by flowering early pod set. If we've got that, I don't see this rapid yield decline at the back end of this because we're not building leaf area. Now, we still get a decline up here. I blame that on shorter days. All of us in here recognize that. Less sunlight during the day. We compress that cycle, less time. There's a lot of other factors, but in our area, this is the big one. So from this here on out, I'm going to focus on this problem. This is our main problem in the Mid-Atlantic. We've tried kitchen sink approaches. I've tried everything I can to get double crop yields up. I made small increments, but this is the big issue. Therefore, our team 4 years ago, we met with 20 farmers throughout this five-state area, and they said we've got to plant earlier. So that's the main thing we're going to talk about. I want this, not this. And by the way, just for your information, this photograph was taken. This is double crop soybean back here. Very typical of a river bottom soil. This is a David Hula type of soil that we can yield 90, 100 bushel on if we have a good year, dry land, or I guess for David, 500 bushels of corn. Back here is more typical of what we're looking at throughout most of this region. So, this is what I teach. This is what I'm going to talk about. Three main principles for double crop production in the Mid-Atlantic area. Position, grow, protect. I try to simplify things as best I can. If you can do these three things, you will be more profitable with that system. Position the soybean for a longer growing season. We've already talked about that today. Grow more leaves. May not be an issue in the Midwest. If we had those soils, it's not a big issue for us where we have the really good soils or under irrigation. But for most of our area, this is the big issue. And then we've got to protect that valuable leaf area. And that's already been talked about. Let's move right into this positioning thing. We do have some early maturing wheat. I know that I can sacrifice a bushel of wheat for every day earlier I can plant. On roughly. Now that's with the prices of wheat, that's changed quite a bit. It takes a little more. I can sacrifice a little more than I used to. But that pretty much holds true, and I tell our breeder here this. The problem is, even though we've been working hard on this, Carl Griffey is our small grain breeder, we've got early maturing varieties that can buy us anywhere from 3 to 5 days, but they just don't yield. We cannot get those yields up to where they need to be. So I won't say we failed at that. Many of our growers are using these early maturing varieties if they can't grow barley. And I haven't even mentioned barley. I'm going to talk mainly about wheat. We just don't have a good market for barley in that area. So we don't grow a lot of barley. Barley would work. We can plant by early June. That works for us. So the next thing we're looking at, let's harvest 20% moisture. Some of you may have seen my five-minute presentation. There's going to be a poster on our research, five-state, three-year project on our results from this research. I'll share some of that with you today. But this is an idea that came out in our discussion with farmers. We had some guys in Pennsylvania that says we're harvesting 20% and drying down because we have to. They may be above that 39-degree parallel. They have to do that. They got to get in there early to meet that window. But then we've actually got an area in Virginia. Manel Millen is buying 20% grain with zero dockage. And that's solely because they want food quality wheat to go into cookies, crackers. We're growing soft red winter. Or as I heard earlier, Krispy Kreme donuts. I like that. I'm going to start using that from here on out. And they see the big issue in quality. They gain profitability. I had one person tell me, they said, I can lose a dollar a bushel and it's still worth it to me. You know, that for drying. And I don't know if they can really do that, especially when wheat, not too much higher than that, but that was probably when wheat prices were better. I want to show you our results, and more detail can be found at this afternoon in my poster. But this is a five-state project, 3 years of data. This is actually 3 years of relative wheat yields. I put it on a relative scale just because our wheat yields are fluctuating from one place to the next. But this is basically what I'm seeing. This is days after first harvest. We were always targeting 20% moisture. I don't think we ever got much higher, lower than 18%. Maybe we got 19 one time. You know, you check it one day, the next day it's dropped 5%, at least in our area, if we got some drying. Most of this, I think, is coming from harvest losses. Now, again, the devil's in the details, and really I pulled the data here, but it pretty much fits a pretty nice graph. We start losing wheat yield around this time, and this is going to be the equivalent of about mid to late June. So typical harvest date, we start losing wheat yield. Some of this is due to test weight. I don't think I'm showing you that data, but that's a linear response. But test weight's not the entire issue with our wheat yield. Okay, there's our soybean yield. The graph looks very familiar. Half a bushel per day after mid-June. One thing I didn't say about Jim's graph, he didn't put a planting date on there. You may have noticed that. Because the optimal planting date for double crop beans ranges anywhere from mid-May to mid-July in this region, right? Now, that may change once we get into Pennsylvania. We can't plant in mid-July. I have seen some of our highest yields by an early July planting, solely dependent on when the rainfall comes. We get good rainfall during seed fill, and that's going to be our best yield. Sometimes our double crop yields are higher than our full season yields, state average. But this is the general trend that we see. Yields are it plateaus, and then it drops off rapidly. Graph looks very familiar. We've put a date on this. Late June, there's a 95% confidence interval. We've got, if we can buy 5 days with early wheat harvest, get this up into here. Now, one thing you'll notice, there's no Pennsylvania data here. There's hardly any Pennsylvania data in that 95% confidence interval, but they're starting to see it when they harvest earlier. So do you understand why these guys in Pennsylvania bought them a grain dryer, continuous flow dryer, to dry this crop down? All right, I'm taking more time than everybody else, so I'm going to speed up a little bit. Position for a longer season. That was our main focus of our research. I say choose as late a maturing soybean variety that will mature before the first frost. Now, I'm giving a presentation tomorrow in the extension section on variety testing that I'll show you the details of that. That doesn't always work. It's very site-specific. In many cases, we're typically a late 4, group 5 state. If I go to our eastern shore, where most of our production is in the Mid-Atlantic, excluding North Carolina, if you get into Virginia, Maryland, the Delmarva Peninsula, intense agriculture, the 4s or even early 4s do very well, and even the mid 4s do very well double crop. Why? I'm not sure. But general, that's my general recommendation. Again, I'm extending the growing season. And this is our data from the 5-year project. Ignore the left side of this graph. I've already basically shown you this data. But here are group 3s through 5s. They're growing to 3s in Pennsylvania, 5s in North Carolina, Virginia. The highest leaf area. Now, we measured leaf area using a Green Seeker. We've correlated that very nicely with NDVI, So we feel like this is a good representation of leaf area. Once we get above about an NDVI reading of 0.85, 0.9, I think we've got enough leaves. We drop below that, and we start getting lower leaf area. We don't always get a lower yield, but we tend to, probability is high. Later planting date, later maturing variety. And the other thing I mentioned, there are caveats to this. Less productive soil, later maturing variety. But once we get into our real productive soils, those early maturing varieties work very well, even in double crop settings. Use a stripper header. Let's speed up the harvest. Now, you run into problems if you're trying to harvest wet land in the fall, because you've got to run that wheat straw through the combine eventually. But this is a great way to get in that field several days earlier, and many farmers are doing this. Plant soybean immediately after wheat harvest. I've stressed this, and usually the planter's in the field the same day the combine is. Just wait until afternoon, or you'll have soil-to-seed contact problems. All right, let's move on to grow more leaves. I've spent a lot of time with this over the years. I've really not had a lot of success, but let's go. This is very important. It's already been mentioned, fertilized for both crops. We remove a lot from this straw baling. And the Eastern Shore especially, we're not getting enough money for our straw just due to nutrients. We need to make up for that. We're losing organic matter. It may make it things a little easier to plant, but I've seen straw remove cause poor stands because we get that hot June, July sun bearing down, and it's in the 90s, and that soil dries quick when you don't have cover. So anyway, the small grain residue, I do believe, is tying up some nitrogen. Okay, we've not seen any effects of inoculants like Jeremy did. I've run numerous tests on that. Inoculants don't seem to help, but I will show you some data we obtained with starter nitrogen. This was banded in between 15-inch rows, right in between, injected in the soil, around 50 pounds, or in this case, well, I can't calculate. This is in bushels per acre. We're only gaining about one bushel an acre, but we consistently did that over seven locations in our double crop setting. So there's something to this. It's not worth it to do it, so I don't recommend it. But this does tell me we're tying up a little bit of nitrogen up front. Especially where we got low leaf area locations, we start seeing a fairly big bump in yields. Now, keep in mind, you get much over 30 pounds, yields start going down. 50 pounds, you're losing more than you're gaining. Losing more than not doing anything. So be careful with that. Select a vigorous soybean cultivar. We started some research on this with our plant breeder. Is there some soybeans that emerge quick, grow fast, that we can make some progress on? This has been discussed over and over, mare's tail, pigweed. Our biggest mistake, I think, in the Mid-Atlantic is trying to get by with one herbicide application. This is being solved. That problem's being solved by this weed because now we're having to use paraquat to burn it down. And we, as far as I know, we don't have any paraquat-resistant crops. Roundup don't work. I think the dicamba 2,4-D is going to help this. Matter of fact, I look and if I have drift concerns now, I look and see if there's double crop beans around for obvious reasons. Grow more leaves. Irrigate early if possible. Don't wait until flowering. I think the guys in Delaware, where we irrigate a lot, Delaware, Maryland, will say yes. I cannot wait. Always wait until flowering because I'm trying to get that leaf area. Narrow rows, higher seeding rates, uniform seed spacing. We've published on this. We've got a poster about our seeding rates at this meeting. Variety selection is mainly maturity group. The uniform seed spacing. I've heard several times today I'd rather plant with a 15-inch planter than a 7.5-inch drill. I 100% agree, but the only place we've seen a significant yield increase is where we, from going from 15 to 7.5, is when we've used a drill that meters at seed. The spacing of soybeans matter for us in double crop production. We've got to protect these leaves. I emphasize that a lot. Not so much from weed control. We're doing that early, but we have published on these burning herbicides, Cobra, Reflex, sometimes even Classic, Synchrony. We can't stunt the growth on these double crop beans. We have shown them to be more harmful to double crop than full season. Jeremy did a very good job on this. I believe that we'll be spraying double crop beans more than full season beans, because it's later in the year, we've got more insects. Corn earworm is our biggest problem, but now it's become stink bug. Defoliators, we have shown that we cannot tolerate defoliation in double crop beans after we enter reproductive stages if that leaf area is less than 3.5 to 4. We published on that, as you can see, many years ago. My fear, and the reason I don't push spraying these minor nibbling defoliators like the ones you see here, green clover worms are a big one. The reason I don't push that, because they'll spray them with pyrethroid, that'll take out our stink bugs. For our situation, we're looking at 30-40% resistance to pyrethroids with corn earworm, soybean pod worm, cotton boll worm, call it what you want. So there's a problem there, but where I've seen early sprays, then we end up with a much bigger problem. If we kill all the beneficials and a pyrethroid won't touch the soybean looper, I've seen this occur within a week. Beans look good. Open up that field for soybean looper on a good hot dry year, and he'll come in and eat the crop. He'll literally eat your lunch. I'm concerned about that. I really think with our foliar diseases, well, let me just say this. We get a response to foliar fungicides in Virginia about 30% of the time, one-third of the time. My research in double crops leads me to believe we get a response about 50% of the time in double crop, mainly due to the ones you see here, Cercospora blight and frog eye leaf spot. Consider tram lines. If we're going to spray more, reproductive stages for various reasons, weeds, insects, diseases, we've published on this. This will save you some money. And I don't think by skipping a couple of rows every today with today's planters every 30 or 40 feet is going to cause that much yield loss. Okay, it's two double-edged sword here. Especially on cyst nematode, double cropping will help you reduce the numbers because you're planting late. We're starving those nematodes for an extra month. But we're trying to solve that late planting problem, so maybe that won't be as big of an issue. But if you do have nematodes, they're worse on double crop. So if you got nematodes in the field, maybe that's not where you want to put your double crop beans. But maybe that's where you want to put them just because you might be able to reduce the number for your full season beans that you may grow there next after that. So position, looks like I'm right on time, folks. Position, grow, protect. That's what I emphasize. We got to extend that growing season, number one. Lots of good reasons. Grow more leaf area and then protect those. I need to thank not only the United Soybean Board that really got us started with this three-year multi-state project, but most importantly, our state soybean boards. They really stepped up to the plate when we lost some funding from the USB and basically fully funded this project between five states. But honestly, for that five-state region, I calculated we're spending $200,000 a year on double cropping systems. And that may not sound a lot to you guys in the Midwest that have millions of dollars. We only have $1 million maybe between the five states to spend, so at least on agronomic issues. So that's quite a bit. So many thanks there. Now, I'm going to try and transition into our discussion period with these slides. Looks like we've got about 15 minutes left. That's our discussion question, but I want to say what are our future efforts. Here are some of the things we've got funding from in Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. We're moving on with these council. Not a lot of funding. This is seed funds. We need more funds. And these are our objectives. I won't go through them. A lot of that's combining early wheat planting with early wheat harvest, maturity group, everything we learned into a system. I also want to compare this cover crop system with a double crop system, okay? Which one's really most beneficial? and we need to collect some soil measurements. We don't have the funding. We've tried for some funding. We've submitted funding through, you know, Foundation for Food and Agriculture. NRCS, we were not funded because this didn't fit their objectives. Well, duh, wonder why. Because they're pushing cover crops in our area. And if I want to get on my soapbox, I can stay up there on that for a while, but I'll say no more. We a few of us submitted nationally. This is what we've submitted projects for. The last one we submitted was to the foundation program with NIFA. You know, $500,000 sounds like a lot of money, but if you got to divide it over six, seven, eight universities over 3 or 4 or 5 years that you need to do double crop work, doesn't go very far. So another thing I want to bring up a question, maybe during our discussion, should we form a double cropping community, expand that to multi-cropping systems, not just small grain soybean, but let's expand it to relay cropping, let's expand it to, you know, I don't want to include cover crops, okay? We got enough communities with that. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm going to open everything up for questions. I'm going to leave this on the board, and the speakers, if why don't you just come on up front, the ones that are still here. I know Doug had to leave early. He was involved with another section, but let's have a discussion. We've got at least 10 minutes left, probably 15 minutes, to discuss, ask questions for anybody that needs to ask questions, and discuss this double crop soybean section. Yes, sir.
The gentleman in Arkansas, you flashed up a graph on K2O. It didn't look like you maxed out your at 240 pounds. I listened to high yield guys that are doing 100, 150, 160 bushels. They have convinced themselves that potassium is a big, big deal. Is that piece of that puzzle? Are we in double crop? That's an issue because you got much soil. How do we address that issue?
Yeah, the question, I'm going to try to repeat the question. The question was on potassium fertilizer. And I won't go into details of your question, but we'll try to answer those. We just completed 3 years of research, going to be published in Agronomy Journal or Soil Science the next few years. But I want Jeremy to maybe come up first. So since you directed the question to Jeremy for Arkansas, let him give you an answer on that first.
Yeah, so our normal recommendations, you know, if you pull a soil sample, you know, it's usually going to be about 60 bushel potential. But we've got a number of farmers, you know, going over that 100 bushel mark. And so, you know, we're having to work with them, you know, and they feel like they're pulling, and of course they're pulling more off. But we do feel like, you know, we're having to kind of push those recommendations and really don't know where the limit is, you know. And, you know, it's a challenge to kind of cater to those big guys that are pushing those 100, but, you know, on the flip side, you know, 98% of the farmers are in that, you know, 50, 60 bushels. And so you got to kind of play that fine line between working with the high-end guys and trying to keep up with them, because a lot of them are, you know, pretty innovative and doing a lot of different things, but you don't want to neglect the majority of the farmers out there and really push a lot of these fertility issues that, you know, under normal situations, you know, they're not going to need those really high ends. But
your 240 is on normal stuff, right? That's not a high yield environment.
That's on the extremes. I mean, that we usually a normal recommendation is about a 160. You know, like a 060, 160 or something like that. You know, we got a lot of 060, 60s, but, you know, that's under some pretty poor soils that we're really pushing, you know, some of those higher rates. But under normal conditions, we typically don't push more than 160 or we start seeing some salt problems, you know, in those high potassium rates. And we already have some soils that are inherent high in chlorides. And so we've got some areas where we're having to grow excluder varieties, and we test for excluder varieties in our OVTs. And so we've got some areas where it's just inherent having high chlorides, and then if you have low potassium, you have to add, you know, quite a bit more potassium to those that just exacerbates the problem.
One thing I need to say about potassium regarding the Mid-Atlantic, again, we just completed some work First of all, any fertilizer, fertilize for both crops. We've got to do that. Up till now, we haven't seen any difference. I think you or someone else showed it, that it didn't matter whether you put it all on the fall or split it. And we're basically the same way, even though we're conducting research right now to answer that question. In the Mid-Atlantic, and I don't know if this matters to anybody here other than me, but sandy soils, they leach. Potassium leaches. One thing that I think we found from this research, well, one thing's for sure, we're pulling up a lot of nutrients that have leached down. And some areas, well, exceptions, we've got as much at 2 feet as we've got at 6 inches. Many areas, we've got as much at 12 inches as we do six. Matter of fact, our recommendation from that work was 12-inch samples the best. But we're pulling this up, bringing it back to the top. I think we found that we need less potassium in double crop than we do full season because of that reason. But that is going to be very dependent on what we have. But again, I emphasize we've got to meet the needs of both crops, whether it's potassium or phosphorus.
I actually have a question for them. Sorry. So how much is irrigated and how much water do you guys put on double crop?
If you look at soybean production, 85% of the soybean, all the soybean is irrigated. And then 100% is double crop. But if you look at the previous years, I mean, we're less than 5% double crop in the state.
So is that overhead? Is that flood with you guys?
Kind of like with the row spacing, we're all over the okay. A lot of it's furrow irrigated, but in the rice regions, it's flood irrigated because they don't want to do a lot of land moving. There's been more and more land moving and trying to get more precision level areas. But furrow irrigation is probably number one, and then flood irrigation, and then overhead irrigation.
David, do you guys hear you?
First of all, Virginia, North Carolina, I guess even South Carolina is not a heavily irrigated state. I don't think Pennsylvania is either. The only place we're going to irrigate a lot is the Delmarva Peninsula. Yeah. Delaware, probably 60% or more. The other issue is we're getting 50 inches of rain a year. It doesn't always come when we need it. And these soils, you know, the common saying is a farmer will always tell you I'm 10 days from the last rain to a drought because of our soils. So, but, you know, I've seen anywhere between 2 and 10 inches, but we're not going to put up a center pivot to irrigate beans.
No.
Okay, we're going to do it for corn, and the beans are the extra, but I would say they're going to, you know, anywhere between, depending on the year, 2 and 10 inches for that. Another
so
question?
So that driving this inoculant issue. I mean, if this was farmers and you said that you shouldn't inoculate your April beans, but you should your June beans, how many people would say, well, I agree with you on that?
So the question is, I think,
is it how mainstream, how difficult is it going to be to sell inoculum late versus early? And is it your irrigation that's driving the value proposition of that versus?
Okay.
Because there's moisture that
right.
That instigation.
So the question is, how are we going to get farmers to change over looking at late season inoculants? And is the irrigation driving that? I don't know if so much the irrigation is driving that. Our theory is that, you know, as you delay planting, the vegetative growth is, shortened. The reproductive phase really doesn't change that much. And so our theory is that with the inoculant, you've got the bradyrhizobium are there, and so you're accumulating a little bit more nitrogen for once you go into reproduction. And so, you know, with the earlier planted, you got a longer vegetative growth stage, so they're able to accumulate enough nitrogen. As you shorten that with the inoculant, you know, you're able to generate a little bit more nitrogen. That's our theory, and we're still trying to work on that. But I don't know if the irrigation, you know, and I've had that question. You know, somebody said, well, if I'm planting non-irrigated late in the season, do I need to put an inoculant? We haven't looked at that, and we're going to look at that in the future. But I would say you're probably not going to see near the impact with the inoculant just because you're going to have those drought stresses. And any stress is going to inhibit nitrogen fixation. And so you're probably not going to see the benefit with those inoculants with the late planted non-irrigated as you are with the irrigated. So does that answer your question?
I do not want to take away from the poster session, which starts in a few minutes, because we have actually a lot of double crop posters there. But is there another question that we could take before we disband for the day? Yes.
Yeah. Question is about using a stripper header in the relay system. I actually, in the idea of the relay being in the northern area where the growing season's short, I would not be a fan of that. You're shading that sucker out, and so that's the advantage of pushing those beans down and getting the stubble shorter, is that now they're up and above and they're going to bush out and grow like crazy. So I would not be a fan of a stripper for a relay. Now, if we were trying to do true double crop in that area, a stripper is fine by me, and maturity groups are going to be at least a unit and a half less, at least, than their full season. That's where we're starting to see some actual double crop yields. Yeah.
But we some of our producers, especially the rice producers, use their stripper headers. And so in the past, some of the wheat guys have used them. But, you're leaving 2 foot of stubble. And so those beans get really long and leggy and stretching, trying to reach that, above that canopy. And so, there's some advantages, disadvantages, but, you get shading,
with our short season, we need them to run off
right
in that situation.
So in our situation, it's a little bit different. We got a little bit longer growing window. But that shade kind of prevents, loss of moisture and everything like that. So we've seen some advantages with it, but a majority of our guys are still using the flat, just a normal header on a wheat.
Just another note on the stripper header. I like it. I love to plant into a stripper header. If it's not on the ground, it plants much easier. I don't care if I've got 8 foot tall rye. I don't want to roll it. I want to keep it up tonight. I'll roll it with my planter. But our literature review that we've done on double cropping in U.S. is suggesting that 12-inch height cutting is the best for soybean yield. We did one experiment last year, and we kind of showed that with that one experiment, but I'm not going to go just on one experiment. I still like a stripper header for the reasons I described for our situation. The etiolation is not a bad thing, because if you mow, I've had some growers that, I think it was give their son something to do when they were younger, but they would mow that with a flail mower after they used a stripper header. And he liked it because he liked the mulch, but he wanted to plant into that. But if you want to if you want to miss some pods, then plant in late June or July, because those lower pods, they'll be very low to the ground. So come harvest, I think that etiolation may even help us a little bit, because that height, the first pod goes up a little higher and you're able to capture more yield at harvest. Okay, we're going to end here. Be sure to attend the poster session. Thank everyone for your attendance and presentation.